All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
It's NPR News, and I'm Mike Mulcahy. It's Friday. That means we're talking about Minnesota politics this hour. The debate over public safety at the Minnesota Capitol is focusing on Twin Cities Metro Transit, and more specifically on light rail transit. In part, that's because of a 35% increase in serious crime on the light rail system in 2019 compared to the year earlier. Serious crimes includes things like robberies, aggravated assaults, and thefts. There's also been a rise in lower-level infractions, smoking, drinking, fare evasion. All of this has drawn the attention of the legislature and of transit officials. And one of those transit officials is Charlie Zelli. He's the person Governor Tim Walz chose as chair of the Metropolitan Council, which oversees Metro Transit. Mr. Zelli was the transportation commissioner under former Governor Mark Dayton. Now he's heading the Met Council, and he joins me in the studio. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Mike. I'm happy to be here.
Now, I know you have a plan, and I know you want to talk about it, but I wonder if we could just start, first of all, how did we get in this situation where things have gone downhill, especially on the LRT trains?
Well, it's a great question. Thank you. And I would say over the years, it is not neglect, but just some of the trends we're seeing in many of our urban communities and suburban communities, that there's incidents of, I would call, petty crimes. Generally, it's safe, but I think that there's enough kind of experiences that has gotten our attention.
And so just what you might call petty crimes or nuisance crimes, things like smoking, people smoking marijuana.
Loud music.
Yeah.
Bad behavior. I come at this not just as the commissioner of transportation. I've had 35 years managing safety cultures, and I'm the third generation bus guy. I managed, I was the CEO of Jefferson Lines, our family business, for 25 years. I know that safety cultures doesn't happen just with good intentions and posters. You actually have to have a devoted resources. You have to have a plan. And so I come at this, even though I'm new on the job, I come at this with a real dedication that this is a problem we can solve.
Well, why hasn't Metro Transit been able to get a handle on it so far?
I think that there has been concerted efforts, and so I don't want to denigrate any of the efforts that have been made. But I think that the Wes Kustra, who's our new general manager, really on the job for the past 9 months, has been devoting more police presence, more activity to help solve this. But I think really in this past few weeks, we're really kind of raising the issue to the top priority, because I come at this as operations first. We want to expand the transit system in this metro area because it's so critical for the lifeblood of our economy, for people's lives. This is how we get to our jobs, to our schools, to our doctor's appointments. And interestingly enough, the light rail system has had gradually increase in ridership every year, even though some of these nuisance crimes are trending up. So is ridership. And so is basic petty nuisances around all of Minnesota. So, you know, I've come at this with a point of view that this is a customer service enterprise. We have to maintain operations to give a welcoming and safe environment for the people and our employees. So we're doing a number of different initiatives, obviously increased presence from police. We have now incorporating live streaming cameras. We're cleaning the trains with more cleaners. We're increasing the number of people watching the screens and the texting programs. Mm. So it's never any one thing. It's a number of things. And it's very gratifying that the legislature, frankly, on a bipartisan basis, is recognizing that there is a role that the state could play. And one of those roles is declassifying of the penalties for not paying a fare.
Right.
And that is not about reducing our enforcement. It's actually dramatically increasing our enforcement.
Well, let me ask you about that, because at first blush, it seems kind of counterintuitive. You know, I think it's a $180 fine now if you don't pay the fare.
Right.
You want to reduce that, and it, is it a felony now if you don't pay the fare?
It is. It goes on your record, and frankly—
So how does reducing that actually make people more willing to pay the fare?
Well, the penalty we don't think fits the crime. To not pay $2.50 fare, and you get a $180 fine, and it goes on your permanent record, you know, frankly, the prosecutors aren't pursuing it. Out of the 6,000 travelers who were cited either with warnings or citations, only 45 of them actually paid a fine. So it's just not working. And we need to declassify it, because with it as an administrative offense, be closer to a parking ticket. We can have other personnel. We call them ambassadors, but, you know, frankly, ambassadors have done a good job in Minneapolis in helping create a sense of safety. We want to have ambassadors on our trains with very strong Metro Transit uniforms, and they'll be able to check fares. They can give citations, and we can collect those citations with collection agencies or how you'd ever pay a parking ticket. Mm-hmm. To me, that is a way we get multiple goals, create a safe presence, and we're able to actually enforce our fare policy.
Well, let me get back to the ambassadors in a second, but Metro Transit does have its own police force.
We do.
I think when I looked, it was 120 full-time officers and 60 part-time officers. Why isn't that force enough to get this job done?
You know, we want that force, which we are increasing. Many of those part-time police officers are now spending many more hours. With the help of some other police jurisdictions, we're devoting more of our transit police on the trains, on the buses, on the platforms. But, you know, they can't be everywhere. We're a spread-out system, and we want them focusing on the more dangerous areas to be able to respond to either video or text calls for help. And if we have a wider presence, more eyes and ears on our trains, both police and ambassadors will be able, and cameras, will be able to kind of leverage all those to create an environment that is A, enforced, and B, bad behavior is just not acceptable.
And, okay, back to the ambassadors now. Is this like a conductor or a driver? Would this person be in every train car?
Not in every train car, but have a presence throughout any trip. They will be on the platforms. They'll be making spot checks. They'll be clearly identified. And they're there to, you know, if somebody's playing their music too loud, they say, hey, cut it out. If that's a problem, if they run into where they need backup, they'll have the transit police ready to respond. So we've found, and I certainly know that the Downtown Council has had great success with the Downtown Improvement District, having ambassadors who help kind of create a more welcoming, more safe environment. And you know, I've found working on safety for all these years, there is no one thing. And frankly, we could always be open to new ideas. We should be studying even more actions that we can take. But part of it is to kind of set a goal, be clear that we are going to absolutely confront this and make sure that people know that it's safe to ride a train. Frankly, 99.9% of the time, people take the green line, the blue line, and have a great trip. It's just those odd incidences that we got to make sure we nip in the bud.
Have other cities been having the same problems, and have they taken similar approaches to try to fix them?
I think there's a number of other cities that are actually looking at reducing the penalties for fare evasion. They have actually looked at multiple strategies, and we're certainly sharing what we're doing. We're learning from others. So you're right. We're not alone. This is not just a Minneapolis-St. Paul issue. But I think, you know, when we think about safe atmosphere and customer service, it is something to stay ahead of. We have to put the resources to make sure that we are going to have a goal that we meet, And then it's easier to kind of stay at that goal than it is to kind of be behind. And I think we've slept a little, but we certainly haven't gone so far that we can't regain it.
The sort of knee-jerk comment you see a lot of the time is, why don't we just have turnstiles? Wouldn't that solve this fare evasion problem? And we never should have built the thing without turnstiles. Is that even possible to put turnstiles in now? And
well, the system was designed without turnstiles, and it is not a philosophical, it's more of a practical solution as to how you are able to have the Green Line, which is in the middle of University Avenue. We know that in some cities, turnstiles, like in New York, that doesn't solve people from doesn't prevent people from jumping over the turnstile. So, but you know what? We should study it. We should think about certain points. Maybe we do need engineering solutions. I've certainly learned in the Department of Transportation, the way that we reduce fatalities on our state highways by half was not just engineering solutions. It was education, it was enforcement, and emergency response, the four E's. And very similar principles apply here. We can take it so far, and we accept our responsibility at Met Transit, but we need the help of our cities, our communities, our other police forces working in tandem. At the Mall of America, we had Metro Transit Police, we have Mall of America Police, we have Bloomington Police. They work hand in hand. So this is a larger issue than just transit. But in terms of a customer service experience, we had to put a stake in the ground, and we put that stake in there firmly.
I think if I remember the price tag, you were talking about $1.8 million in overtime for police. And then what would the ambassadors cost, and who would pay for that?
Well, we'd have to we've put that much of our reserves and any available resources we've been applying toward increased police presence, toward increased monitoring presence. Know that with ambassadors over a period of years as it ramps in, it would take more resources. We would be part of our operating budget, and you know what? Our operating budget is something that we certainly need to face in the coming budget year. There's no question that good intentions doesn't solve the problem. We need to actually put our attention and focused resources on it. So we'll certainly be talking to the legislature about that, and I've been very gratifying that we've had the attention from all sides of the Capitol to address this issue.
We did get a comment from a listener who said that, first asked whether trains and buses here are significantly less safe than any other city, and said the whole issue with safety seems to be a bit overblown. To be honest, there have been hints of racism with both the light rail transit and metro area crime that some are trying to make an issue of. Do you have a response to that?
Well, I think we're very similar to other cities. And I think they raise a good point that we have a number of homeless late in the evenings that come into our trains especially. And, many have paid a fare. It is not illegal to be poor. And we have to have a concerted effort toward our unsheltered homeless. And many, this becomes a kind of a racial issue. What I say is we need a safe presence for everybody who is part of our system. And to profile particular people is inappropriate. We know that in the evenings, we've now had our homeless action team, which is part of the police force, help bring people to permanent homes. We actually, in Met Council, have a housing authority. Mm-hmm. So we've actually been able to dedicate vouchers toward helping those homeless who are on our trains. You know, we have a number of tools. We've gotten great reception from the community, from foundations. Met Council, we devoted $1 million toward an immediate need of homelessness. And I think that there's always a concern that when you create fear of crime, that becomes a racial issue. We want to make sure that we don't do that. And I think that even our most vulnerable and business executives going to the airport, everybody uses the train. And that's the way we want it.
Charlie Zelli, Chair of the Metropolitan Council, thanks so much for coming in today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for the opportunity.
This is NPR News. I am Mike Mulcahy. You know, one of the big to-do items on the list at the Minnesota Capitol this year is a public works construction bill. It's known as the bonding bill because the state sells bonds, essentially borrows money to pay for the projects. Governor Tim Walz has proposed a $2 billion bonding bill, which most Republicans and some Democrats say is too big. Keeping a close watch on the issue is the leader of the state's largest higher education institution, University of Minnesota President Joan Gable. She joins us now from our office at the Capitol. President Gable, thanks for coming on today.
Thanks for having me.
The governor recommended about $224 million in bonding for the university this year. The biggest part of that is $125 million or so just for basic upkeep, you know, fixing the roof, things like that. Is that about what you were looking for?
Our original ask was for $200 million. It's pretty close to what we asked for, and we will certainly put every penny that's offered to us to good use.
The university asked for and the governor recommended $29 million to replace the child development building on the Twin Cities campus. Why is that project important? Why do you think you need to do that now?
That's correct. So that's a really interesting project, and some of your listeners may recall that that's where the governor and the lieutenant governor kicked off their bonding tour around the state, because that building houses the nation's number one developmental psychology program. And developmental psychology is where we study and train clinicians and practitioners in infant and child brain health, which is a conversation we have so much today. I have learned recently how important the first 3 years of life are, first 1,000 days, and we are the world and country certainly is best researchers and educators in this space. And the faculty who specialize in this area, the students who are studying in this area, sit in a building. The core part of the building is 100 years old. There are no undergraduate classrooms in that building. There are some additions that are also aged. None of the structure can hold the kind of equipment that we use today to do the kind of brain analysis or research or instruction, student preparation in this field. And we want to serve the state of Minnesota and therefore the country and really even the world with the advances we're making in developmental psychology, and we want the space to match those ambitions.
Mm-hmm. A couple other things the university asked for and the governor is also requesting. $66 million for an undergraduate chemistry teaching lab on the Twin Cities campus and $4.4 million to renovate Anderson Hall on the Duluth campus. Why are those buildings important?
So I'll start with Duluth because mm-hmm. that's a classroom building. It offers most of the core classes that our Duluth students take. And the University of Minnesota at Duluth is a real gem in the portfolio of the system in terms of the quality of the instruction and opportunity for students who want to attend on a campus of that size. But it's also a really big commitment by the university system to that part of the state. And so having the opportunity to offer top-notch classroom space, that building was built in the 70s. It hasn't been updated at all since then, and it isn't suited for modern day instruction and what we know about what it takes to make students be successful. So we're very committed to that campus and that region, and this support would allow us to fulfill that commitment. But then coming back to the Twin Cities, the chemistry lab is the lab space for every student who takes chemistry. It is also in its original condition, even older than A.B. Anderson. And all of us who took chemistry labs in college remember what they were like. I did that a long time ago.
Mm, me too.
And the space looks just like it did when I took chemistry. And that's not how we teach chemistry anymore. And we also have a lot more students using the space than we did then. And if the students don't take chemistry, they can't fulfill any of the STEM fields, health sciences, any of the fields where the workforce demands are across the state. So we want space so that we can really meet the needs of the quantity of students at the quality that's expected of us so that they can be the workforce of the future here in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm. Well, so the governor is on board for most of what you asked for. What about the legislature? What's the sense you get from lawmakers as you talk to them?
Well, so far, so good. And as I've said many times, it's been wonderful to arrive in the state where the entire elected official body is in support of education. And then it just comes down to the details. So We've testified before the House and Senate Higher Ed Committees and the House Capitol Committee. Lots of questions, but questions offered in a spirit of understanding. It has felt supportive, like there is a commitment and a recognition that this is a good time to do bonding. And then it's just a question of the exact amounts, which we hope to hear soon.
Mm-hmm. And so how do you make the case? What is your pitch to legislators as you talk about these projects?
Well, we really start with how we are mission-driven to serve students, to educate them for their next chapter of life, and how we serve the state with top-quality research, and that both of those things are the legs of the stool of higher education. And our students are ambitious, our faculty are ambitious, the state wants us to deliver, and we do too. And we want our facilities and our infrastructure to match those ambitions so that we can move resources out of infrastructure and directly to our students, keeping costs down and keeping higher education affordable. And then we also point out that we have a $4.8 billion backlog on infrastructure repair. That's a lot of money. Mm-hmm. We're a big campus. We are five campuses. We cover the entire state. And the resources we ask for are also designed to make sure that we don't fall any further behind. So on the one side of the coin, we have the mission that we are deeply committed to in an affordable and accessible way. And on the other hand, one of the best investments you can make is in maintaining buildings so that you don't go into crisis with their condition.
Mm-hmm. So what happens if you don't get the money you think you need?
Well, we aren't able to move as quickly and we fall further behind, the backlog increases. We have to work around infrastructure barriers to how we teach students in the best possible way. We have to move general revenue into infrastructure that we might otherwise put directly towards student support.
Mm-hmm. You talk about keeping the university affordable. It seems like all colleges and universities are in kind of an arms race to build new buildings and new, sometimes really flashy buildings to attract students. And I just wonder what you think about that, given how much it costs to maintain the buildings. You were just talking about that. Doesn't this kind of just drive up the cost of higher education to put up a lot of new buildings? Wouldn't it make more sense to maintain the existing ones?
I couldn't agree more. That's exactly what we're asking for. We have no new buildings in our ask. This is all within our footprint and just making the buildings that we have the most innovative, modern, effective. It makes them more efficient. It makes them have a lower carbon footprint. It makes the teaching we can do more effective. And that is exactly how we keep costs down for students, is by making sure that we aren't doing crisis repairs when things actually break, but are actually just incrementally investing in the infrastructure with an eye towards quality and in the spaces where we're doing research and instruction in the fields where the state needs us the most.
Hmm. In general, do you think the University of Minnesota is a good deal for the students who go there?
Well, yes, I think the University of Minnesota is a great deal. We sit right in the middle of our peers in terms of cost. That doesn't mean it's not challenging to attend, and it doesn't require a really hard decision-making process by families, which we fully appreciate and respect. I have my own children in college. I'm a tuition-paying parent myself. I took student loans myself. We make these decisions really thoughtfully in how much we cost. We have external third parties come in and look at our costs to make sure that we sit in the average. We have a reputation for being cost heavy, both in terms of tuition and in terms of what it costs to run us. It's really not the case. We've just been reviewed by a third party consultant who we did not pay very much money to look to us and tell us where we sit with overhead, and we sit right in the middle. So we're investing in students at the right level so that we can maintain quality without being too expensive. But every decision we make is with the tuition-paying family and the tax-paying family in mind, so that when you do pay tuition, it's into something that will yield for you, into professional opportunities, cures when you go see one of our doctors, innovations when you need a new piece of equipment, or entrepreneurship opportunities if you want to start that business yourself.
And this is the same case you make to lawmakers as to why the University of Minnesota is a good investment for taxpayers.
Yes, it's exactly the same case. I mean, it's a very consistent story, and it's something that all of our Board of Regents is very committed to and the faculty want to be a part of. And we think it's why a student should come here, but we also think it's why the investment in the university as a family or as a taxpayer is something that you can expect and should account for a yield.
University of Minnesota President Joan Gable, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. I hope the rest of your day is great.
You too. Another contest in the race for the Democratic presidential nomination is tomorrow, when Nevada holds its caucuses. It's the most ethnically diverse state to weigh in yet, only the third state. Our reporters have their eyes on it, and two of them join me now, Brian Baxt and Mark Zedeklik. Mark, you are in Las Vegas following the Amy Klobuchar campaign. Last week we were talking about her strong debate performance in New Hampshire. This week it was a different story when she was on the debate stage in Nevada, right?
It was. She has not been lauded for an exceptional performance. It was a raucous debate, and Amy Klobuchar, who's kind of known for being calm and cool and collected but able to stand her ground, as evidenced during the Kavanaugh hearings, kind of lost her cool with Pete Buttigieg, and just kind of a shouting match. And finally, Elizabeth Warren got everybody to settle down. But it showed a different side of Senator Klobuchar that she's not been cultivating, you know?
Mm-hmm. Are you getting any sense out there that she has much support in the caucuses?
It's hard to say. The campaigning here has been very different than it was in Iowa and in New Hampshire. There are much fewer events. And Senator Klobuchar, since she did so well in New Hampshire and was able to take in, you know, really more than $10 million in just several days, has been going back to the honey jar over and over and flying actually out of Nevada and heading into Colorado yesterday for a fundraiser. She's been in other states for fundraisers. So she's got a bunch of stuff going on at once right now. She's got an ad running in South Carolina, which comes up after Nevada a week from Saturday. And her attention is not just solely focused here as the way it was leading up to the Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary in those states.
Well, does that mean she's looking beyond Nevada, that she, you know, is already starting to look at Super Tuesday states and the campaign will go on no matter how well she does in Nevada?
I think that's absolutely going to be the case. Obviously, it'll be up to her to decide whether she's going to continue on once the votes are counted tomorrow. But she's running ads in South Carolina. She announced an ad buy in a bunch of Super Tuesday states, including Minnesota, I believe, and asked at the debate. Everybody except for Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders said that even if nobody has enough to clinch, they should. Everybody should stay in and just work this out the way the rules allow it to. So there's no indication that Senator Klobuchar is about ready to wrap it up.
Okay. And Brian Baxt, speaking of TV ads, the person who's been running the most ads in this campaign has been Michael Bloomberg, the former New York mayor. He got beat up pretty good in that debate the other night. Do you think that will hurt him?
Well, he definitely was the shiny object on the debate stage. It was his first debate, and so a lot of the campaigns and candidates were going after him. He was shaky, and he admitted as much the next day. This was the first chance for people to really press him on things because he has been running this above-it-all strategy where he's just focused on TV and in states that are further down the calendar than the early voting states. He's going to have to kind of polishes his performance up when next week's debate rolls around. His campaign says that he's going to be more prepared, but there's no sense that he's not going to be the same target he was this week.
And speaking of money, he's got plenty of it and spending all his own. But the other
more than you and I.
Well, that's for sure, and more than we'll raise in this member drive this week, I'm sure. But what about the other candidates? What do we know about where they stand with money right now?
Well, it's kind of hard to tell because some of these candidates get a little burst of activity around key moments in the campaign. Right now, Elizabeth Warren is pulling in a lot of money because people thought that she did well on the debate stage in Las Vegas. Amy Klobuchar had the same phenomenon last week in New Hampshire after scoring a decent showing. So they all came in, a lot of these top-tier candidates came in to February on fumes. They were very close to bottoming out. They've been able to replenish some. But keep this in mind. Amy Klobuchar for the campaign through the end of January has spent $31 million. Michael Bloomberg in January spent $220 million, a lot of that on these Super Tuesday states. So they can't compete with his money. They need to get exposure in other ways.
Mm-hmm. And they need to beat him up on that debate stage when they have the chance, if they want to beat
him. Which is why we saw the dynamic we did the other night.
How do you see this shaping up? Now, there was a question at that debate about whether the candidates can go all the way to the convention. Do you think there will be, like, a clear front runner when the convention comes, when the primary season is over, or not?
I think you're definitely going to see a winnowing in the weeks ahead. Not all these campaigns can be able to afford to go on. And there might be some pressure on the kind of the moderate middle lane, I guess, to consolidate some, because people feel like Bernie Sanders is starting to pick up momentum and could amass a delegate count that will make him hard to top later down the line. Michael Bloomberg has already pressured some of these folks to step aside. They said they're not going to step aside for him, but there will be some of these conversations, no doubt, in the days ahead. If these candidates can't show well in Nevada and South Carolina, it's going to be tough for them to keep the money coming in and to keep making the case that they have a viable path to the nomination.
Mark Zdechlik, what do you think about Amy Klobuchar? Can she stick it out through Super Tuesday, which is just about, 10 days away now? And can she keep going after that?
I think there's no question she can stick it out until Super Tuesday. It's not that far away. She is in the best fundraising position that she's been in since she launched her campaign more than a year ago. And I think that I have no reason to believe that she wouldn't easily be able to continue on through Super Tuesday. Then after Super Tuesday, like Brian said, I think the field will change and winnow people. I think that that's a much more, even with so many candidates, that setting that as the target to kind of make some decisions, I think probably makes sense for a lot of campaigns that are in it this far, you know?
Mm-hmm. And we should say Super Tuesday is March 3rd. Minnesota's primary is that day too. And Brian, we can say that starting Sunday and into next week, we'll have the results of a new NPR News Star Tribune poll, and we'll get a sense of where the candidates stand in Minnesota.
And I've been talking to some of these poll respondents, and I can just say this without giving too much away, that this race is a bit fluid. Even folks who express preferences for one candidate say they could easily go with another candidate. We've got a lot of ballots already in the bank. The Secretary of State's office today released new figures that said 36,726 people have already cast ballots, and twice that many have asked for early ballots. And keep in mind, in the context of the 2016 caucuses, there were 300 and about 20,000 people who participated altogether. We're likely to see a bigger turnout on primary day. So, who knows which direction this will go. And a lot of this could be determined on how well these candidates do in the next two contests.
And you would think if a lot of people had their minds made up, maybe more of those ballots, early ballots, would have come in by now.
That's right. And there's a key deadline coming up. If you are someone who has cast an early ballot and your candidate hasn't made it or won't make it to Super Tuesday, you have until this Tuesday to get that ballot back and cast a new one. Otherwise, you're locked in and you might be casting a vote for someone who has exited the race.
Is the legislature any closer to making any changes in the primary? The concern is over voter data. You have to declare a party, and then that choice with your name will go to all the major parties in the state. And some people don't like that.
Absolutely. We're likely to see a vote on the House floor this week of a bill that would restrict how parties can use that data, and even tell the state that after the parties get the data, it has to destroy the data so it's not in the state systems going forward. The Senate is taking a different route, but there is some new willingness in the Senate side to add more privacy measures. The question is whether they can get it done prior to the March 3rd primary, because a lot of people are looking at that saying, if I'm not comfortable with my data being used, do I even go out to vote in that primary?
Mm-hmm. And there were more questions about election security at the Capitol this week, too.
Yeah, there's a pot of money that the federal government set aside, about $7 million that states that Minnesota is entitled to shore up its cybersecurity defenses, but the legislature needs to greenlight that money. And Senate Republicans say they're willing to do that, but they want something else in exchange. They want to add a provisional balloting system to Minnesota, whereas if you go and register on Election Day, your ballot is set aside until more verification can be done that you are actually eligible to vote. Right now, if you register on Election Day, your ballot goes into the pile, so it can't be fished out later.
All right. Well, more things to keep an eye on at the Capitol. Brian Bax, thanks for coming on. Mark Zedeklik, we'll look for news out of you this weekend about what happens in Nevada.
Should be interesting, Mike. And also, unlike Iowa, most of the votes have already been cast in Nevada, apparently, at least expected. It's very interesting how many have already come in. In 2016, there were about 75 or 80,000 altogether.
Mm-hmm.
There are already 70,000 early votes in Nevada that have been cast.
Well, let's hope they can count them, unlike Iowa. We'll see what happens.
We'll see.
All right, Mark, thanks a lot. Thanks, Brian.
Yeah, take care.
You're welcome.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the conversation, you can call in at 651-227-6000 or tweet us at Angela Davis MPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.